The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Dave, we've been talking about Greece, but now it's Spain. You know, these dominoes seem to fall in line with what we're talking about. And, you know, I can't help but think that these guys, the Greeks and now the Spanish, are using the fear of Europe falling apart to their advantage.
Well, I think politicians are certainly prudent to do so.
Right.
That's one of the cards that they can play, and they are playing it very well. Now, when you look at catastrophes, you have this idea that they're somehow once in a blue moon, or you know, like the flood, if you will, the 100-year flood.
Right.
We have 95, we have 97, we have 98, we have the year 2000, we have 2001, we have 2008. What we've seen happen in the last 30 years, really, since the end of the Bretton Woods period, the closing of the gold window and the destabilization, the free floating of all currencies, has been an increase in catastrophes
right.
of a financial and economic nature. Is it any surprise that there's a greater concentration of catastrophes in this particular era than in a period of time where currencies had been, past tense, related to something more solid and reliable?
Well, and you know, you're talking about catastrophe, but you know, the potential for catastrophe gets to be so large when you continue to throw bailout dollars or bailout euros in this particular case. You know, the New York Times just had an article that said there's brinkmanship going on, that Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy of Spain has delayed seeking outside help to increase the fear of an economic disaster, a contagion, so to speak, so that they can get better terms than Greece did. So these guys understand that the consequences are so great that it actually helps to make people fear the consequences to get better terms.
Well, you know, that harkens back to sort of the movie Doctor Strangelove and the Doomsday Machine.
Right.
We have something similar with Europe. You've got the core European banks, which are at risk if the peripheral banks go away. So if the Bankias and the smaller banks relative to the Deutsche Banks and whatnot, so again, banks based in your peripheral countries, if they fail, you've got ramifications into not only those domestic markets, Spain, Italy, but also into the larger banking community throughout Europe. On the one hand, you've got that idea of mutually assured destruction, or the threat of mutually assured destruction. And on the other, you've got a very different kind of problem, more like Y2K, wherein it's an unbounded problem. There's variables that you can't know, can't control, can't figure out, but the potential for contagion, as you just suggested, the potential for demise, the potential for a trigger in the derivatives market, not knowing what the outcome could be, and that uncertainty in the marketplace has people behaving as if we were, in fact, looking at the doomsday machine and mutually assured destruction, where, as you've suggested many times, you have to have perfect information. We have anything but perfect information, and certainly not complete information.
Well, and talk about complete information, you know, it was sort of a stunning text message between the prime minister and his finance minister when they were saying, he was basically saying, look, it's going to take 500 billion, not 150, but it's going to take 500 billion for us, and it's going to take another 700 billion for Italy. So the numbers continue to grow. You had brought up mutually assured destruction, and most of us who are in our 40s or 50s or 60s remember that that was actually a decision made by the Rand Corporation and the government to make everybody realize that this thing was just too horrible to contemplate. And what I'm talking about is nuclear mutually assured destruction. In this particular case, in Europe, we're talking about economic mutually assured destruction. But there's a point where somebody's going to say, you know what, I don't care. I've got a default. And when that happens, then we're going to really see what the cost was of these bailouts.
Well, for today's program, we're going to look at two things. First is just a recap on Greece and Spain and the issues particularly relevant right now in Europe.
Right.
That's about 5 minutes, and then the rest of our conversation will be a preview of coming attractions, both with some of the interviews that we have lined up for the rest of the month, but also sort of our second thematic in this year's DVD, which is Asian ascendance and the implications for the U.S. dollar and bond market. So before we go there, we obviously have Greece as the weakest link in Europe. They've got the election on the 17th, which
right.
is this week, which will reinforce either the we stay or we go attitude there in Greece and could potentially destabilize Europe further or stabilize. Spanish bailout is certainly in the headlines after the weekend. 100 billion euros, which is about $5 billion.
That's about one fifth of what they're saying they really need.
Yeah, the Royal Bank of Scotland, J.P. Morgan, Chase. You've got estimates anywhere from 350 billion euros to 370 to 450 billion euros, and that's what they believe will stabilize the banks.
Isn't that a lot predicated on the real estate market finally stabilizing? I mean, that's still falling in value.
Well, that's right. Coming up with a solid number, there's really no evidence that that stabilization within the real estate market has occurred. So, implying that we may have lower prices in real estate there in Spain, and on that basis, an even bigger hole on bank balance sheets. So this is a moving target. It's not as if we know exactly what the problem is with Spanish banks. We know that they have, according to the New York Times last week, between $2.5 and $300 billion in liabilities that are souring, and thus the solvency of the institutions with which hold those liabilities. That's in play. That's in question. But it is a moving target. Not unlike what Bankia needed a few weeks ago when they needed $9 billion on Wednesday and $19 billion on Friday.
Well, and you know, you had brought up in the past that this isn't really just even a banking issue in Spain. There's also a municipal issue. There are 17 regions that also have a funding problem, I think to the tune of around 45 billion euros.
That's the amount that they have to refinance this year. So you do have pressure on the banks. You do have pressure on the municipalities, let alone on the sovereign debt. And of course, we've seen rates come back down from closer to 7%, now closer to 6%. But this, to me, is a little bit like a scratch in the record, Kevin. Whether we're talking about Greece, Spain, Italy, Ireland, Portugal, when you have a scratch in the record, you can move away from it. But because of the cyclical nature of the record, you're going to return to that same point of pain again. And so the fact that we're not at 7% with Spanish yields or with Italian yields, I would just say wait 60 to 90 days and let's see, because it's going to take us about that amount of time to get back to the scratch.
Well, and it's robbing Peter to pay Paul, because consider that 22% of the bailout funds are coming from Italy, which is the next 700 billion euro problem.
Right, right, right. So what you're talking about is the EFSF bailout fund. The bailout fund is a commitment by a number of countries in Europe to pool assets or resources in the case of a demise, whether it's a banking crisis or an individual sovereign crisis that needs to be addressed. Now, the problem is the ones contributing are also the ones that have problems. So in the case of Italy, as you mentioned, they make a 22% contribution to that fund. And yet, if it's an Italian problem, how do they contribute to their own bailout? And Spain is in the same place, of course.
Yeah, David, you know, it's interesting. When Spain is loaning to Greece, and then later Italy is loaning to Spain, yet they're all bankrupt. You know, it reminds me, you were talking about how it comes back around, but there has always been the problem of a perpetual motion machine. It always takes a little bit more energy than what it produces. And so we don't have a perpetual motion machine. Physics says that it can't happen. And, you know, with this European situation, you can't take a bankrupt country and have them loan money to another bankrupt country and then continue that around and have it last.
Well, the physics of debt, like the perpetual motion machine and not having enough energy to perpetuate it indefinitely, we have that. We have that now with this 100 billion euro bailout. The debt to GDP ratio increases for Spain north of 145%. Now, again, this is not a gift. This is a loan. And again, after that loan is in place, their debt-to-GDP ratio skyrockets to 145%. They've already lost their credit rating several notches last week to triple B.
Which is junk. That's a junk rating.
Two ratings above junk.
Two ratings above junk.
No, right. But on the slippery slope, so to say. And again, this is to us a replay of what we've already seen in Italy, a replay of what we've already seen in Ireland. Oh, by the way, speaking of Ireland, the 100 billion euro bailout to the Spanish banks, it comes with very few strings attached and not very much austerity, which within hours of its announcement over the weekend had Ireland calling up and saying, we want a better deal, we want a new deal, the old deal is too punitive, why do the Spanish get a better deal than we did?
It's like ants at a picnic, you know, it's as soon as you drop a couple of crumbs, they're all there, you know. So, I mean, all these countries can't pay their debt, they know they can't pay their debt, and they know that if they continue to keep Europe worried that they may go do something else, that they're going to continue to get more money. But, all right, now, speaking of more money, are we going to see intervention? I mean, central bank intervention has become sort of the norm. Everyone just sort of expects that next QE, quantitative easing, to come from somewhere. Are we going to see the political pressure actually applied to where we see more money pumped into the system?
Well, we've argued for a long time that the Fed and most central banks around the world are not independent from the political system. But I think we're at an interesting inflection point. I would say, yes, we will see the Fed and the ECB intervene if, and it's a big qualified if, the catastrophe has to be severe enough that they're worried about the survivability of the financial system as we know it.
Because so otherwise we might wonder where they are, because we're seeing, you know, people coming out on the financial TV saying, well, you know, Bernanke's going to give us something here soon. But every time he doesn't, it seems like there's a reaction in the market.
The issue is you've got both Mario Draghi and Ben Bernanke, respectively the presidents of the ECB and the Fed,
right,
and they're looking at politicians that are not implementing any fiscal reforms. They continue to pump money into the system. They continue through QE1, QE2, Operation Twist to accommodate, and yet politicians are not doing their fair share of the heavy lifting in terms of fiscal reform. So I think central bankers are beginning to look and say, listen, if there's a question of survivability, we intend to survive, and we frankly don't care if you get reelected. So you either do the heavy lifting, or we're going to let this fall on your shoulders. So I think we're seeing a line drawn in the sand. Yes, Draghi, and yes, Bernanke will get very active, but if and only if the circumstances are severe enough to require it. Otherwise, I think you're going to see a pretty significant decline in the equities markets as they're disappointed with Draghi's inactivity and Bernanke's inactivity. Again, in light of what? In light of the fact that the liquidity that's already been provided has done little to nothing to solve the employment issues or to stimulate growth in the economy. As you look at those excess reserves of depository institutions now held at the Fed, we'd mentioned this last week, this is liquidity which was intended to stimulate growth, and in fact, it just got redeposited with the Fed. What good did it do? There was sort of this circular nature, and it was ineffective. It was muted. It did nothing, not what it was intended to do in terms of stimulating growth in the economy.
Well, and David, this is one of the reasons why the first segment of the DVD was about Europe, so that we could look at that issue. But actually, there probably is a larger issue. In fact, I know it's a larger issue than Europe. It's our issue. But it's actually how China factors into our issue. You know, we as Americans have a tendency to think that we just sort of run the ship. I know that we've dominated economically for years, but that domination has actually come at a cost. It's come at the cost of great, great debt. And actually, what we've been consuming, and the reason we can have so many products, is because we've been paying China, basically, for undervalued goods, and we've been borrowing money to do it. They turn right back around and loan us the money. It's a circular motion. And so the second segment of the DVD, which you're going to be working on here over the next few weeks, going to China, what have you, is going to be about China and why it matters.
Well, and I just want to quote Stephen Roach, because he stated this very simply. He said, don't confuse prognosis with advocacy.
Right.
And as we discussed for several weeks, the issues related to Asian ascendancy and China in particular, we're not building either a bear or bull case for investment in the region. We're looking for broader implications entailed in the changes that are afoot in that part of the world. And we want to discuss a point of view, again, not to endorse the point of view, but rather to fully appreciate the consequences of what is unfolding and the ramifications into the U.S. debt market and the U.S. dollar market.
Well,
for anyone who hasn't seen that most recent segment of the DVD, we released it online, and you can go to YouTube and view it or view it on our website. The issues primarily concerning us today are the U.S. debt markets and the dollar, concerning us over the next 1 to 3 and 5 year periods. So Asia centers prominently in these concerns to us for what are obvious reasons. Again, at least to us. We should look at a couple of those issues today. Again, the dollar and the U.S. Treasury market stability in anticipation of what the next 3 to 5 weeks will be in terms of the theoretical exploration. And then, as you mentioned, as I go to Beijing and Hong Kong and Singapore, some of the on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground exploration of these same issues.
Well, and you know, some of these changes that we're talking about, Dave, these are earth-shattering changes, because China has been our greatest customer for debt. We've been their greatest customer for goods, and it's been a symbiotic relationship. I mean, we interviewed Paul Craig Robertson. He said, guys, this is simple. We basically would run a $400 to $450 billion deficit, and we would give China a $400 to $450 billion surplus, and they would turn around and give us the money to run that deficit the next year.
Now, but again, that deficit the next year was a different deficit, because we're running a trade deficit with them, okay? And that trade deficit creates a trade surplus. It creates reserve assets, reserve currency assets in their pocket. Now, the question is, how do they continue to be the source, the leading source of manufactured goods in the world? Low-cost, competitive source of goods for the world's consumers. It is by keeping a low currency value. And thus, they can't take their extra cash, the spare change, and reinvest it into their own economy. They did take those funds and instead put it into U.S. treasuries, into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgage-backed securities. They did so much for us over the last 10 to 20 years, particularly the last 10 years, recycling their trade surplus dollars and funding our budget deficit. Our budget deficit, we're spending too much as a country. We don't have the revenue to support it, but that's okay as long as we have a creditor who's willing to give us money. Oh, by the way, that's our own money. They're just giving it back to us as a result of us spending too much money in the first place. Very interesting sort of enmeshed relationship we've had with the Chinese.
And that is changing. And, you know, our guest next week, David, you've been looking forward to talking to Pettis for a long, long time. Pettis writes about these things. He's not necessarily a bull or bear on China either, but it's a complex enough issue, and it does play into the U.S.'s ability to continue to function as a dollar-denominated currency. We need to look at it.
Well, you know, first and foremost, the U.S. has benefited from the privileged position of world reserve currency since 1944.
Bretton Woods,
Bretton Woods Agreement. All currencies related to the U.S. dollar, and the dollar was in turn related to gold. So again, whether this is by muscle memory or by shrewd foreign policy, the U.S. dollar has continued to maintain its stature as the primary world reserve currency, even without that legitimizing relation to gold. And, you know, on more than one occasion, there's been the consideration given by OPEC and other trade partners as to the fairness of that arrangement and also the privilege it affords our country.
Right.
So the issue of reserve currency status is one of the issues we're going to pursue in the context of our Asian explorations.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, though, because now that we're talking about China, there is this conference right now that they've been having on the internationalization of the RMB. And so are we going to see a Chinese currency either as part of a basket of currencies like Barry Eichengreen talked about, or are we going to see the renminbi at least turn into a currency that is internationally traded?
Kevin, it's not without accident that this conference you were making mention of at the University of California, San Diego, the keynote speaker was Barry Eichengreen.
Right.
And, you know, there's quite a layout in terms of speakers, presentations, research that's being done. In one sense, it's inevitable. In the other, it may not happen because there is, as they say, many a slip twixt the cup and the lip. We will have to see if the RMB can become one of the dominant currencies on the world scene. It is significant that they've become the second largest economy in the world. It is significant that they do a tremendous amount of trade regionally, that there is not a lot of transparency in their financial system. There's a number of reforms which will have to take place in their economy before the RMB, the renminbi, can be fully internationalized. And that's what's being discussed now, is what are the steps that need to be taken, again, both economically and politically, for their currency to become more prominent in the world currency system.
Well, David, it's amazing to me, just in, you know, in my adult life, watching China go from something of a communist country that was so backwards in most Westerners' opinion, to over the last 20 years, we're now talking about them possibly becoming a world power, possibly an internationally traded currency. Yeah, you know, poverty levels have dropped. I mean, the growth in the global economy has really benefited China as well as everyone else.
Yeah, both the developed world and the developing world have benefited from growth in the global economy. And this is another critical element in the expansion of trade relations, which, you know, they've blossomed in the context of the late 20th century, and certainly on an accelerated basis following the collapse of communism and the fall of the Berlin Wall. Globalization has changed the face of the developing world, and it's introduced a new audience to modern conveniences and the luxuries which we take for granted here, but frankly were never within reach in parts of the developing world, but they are now as a result of increased employment and consistent wages and things of that nature.
Well, and look at the last three decades. I mean, the World Bank has said that the poverty rate has gone from 65% of the population in China now to about 10% today. So, you know, the World Bank is also seeing this. They came out with a report that's just voluminous on the future of China. But one of the things that you have to see in a country is the rise of the middle class, and you have to see a decline in poverty.
Well, and certainly on an apples-to-apples basis, I mean, you know, 20, 30 years ago, our poverty rate was 40%. 14%. Lo and behold, it's still about 14%. So we haven't made a lot of progress in the United States, but we're not comparing apples to apples with Chinese poverty. I mean, on a per capita basis, our poverty level is just under $6,000 per person per year. And theirs is about a 15 times difference in terms of the threshold for poverty underneath ours. So, you know, again, we're in a much better place when all is said and done, but the progress is being made. You're talking about folks who once were on a dollar per day existence and are now in the $3, $4, and $5 per day existence as a result of mass migration from the agrarian economy to a more industrialized economy, focused with major cities on the coastal parts of China.
Well, and hasn't manufacturing of all sorts sort of migrated to the lowest cost areas around the world? You know,
that's absolutely critical. Yeah. That's what we would call a labor arbitrage, and it's allowed for the cost of production to drop dramatically for almost all consumer goods. You've had the manufacturing of all sorts, which, as you just mentioned, is migrated to the lowest cost areas around the world, and even regionally within those countries. So, you know, while that's cost American jobs, what it's also done, lest we just pick on the American jobs piece, it has significantly reduced the cost of goods and to some degree services, boosting the lifestyle for virtually all Americans.
Well, you know, just thinking about that, look at the cell phone, David. I mean, at one point, not too long ago, you knew a few people who had cell phones.
Five people. Yeah. It was as big as a briefcase.
But now it's not uncommon for kids to have them. I mean, it's an item that we would not have probably had in the kind of quantity that we would have for the price that we have if it weren't for this migration of jobs.
Yeah, kids, not 18-year-olds heading off to college, but kids 10, 11, 12-year-olds who their parents want to keep in touch with them and want to know when Johnny's walking home from school and whatnot. So certainly communication has improved. We like that, not being critical on that point. It's just that this would not be possible if it wasn't for this major labor arbitrage that's resulted from globalization.
Well, it not only causes prices to go down on new technology, but it actually hides inflation a little bit, David, because really the costs of everything should be much, much lower to us if we weren't printing money this whole time.
Well, you're right. So the middle class across the developed, not the developing, but the developed world has had the equivalent of a boost in income. Or as you mentioned, it's at least hidden the inflationary trends within the deflated pricing of imported goods. So imports, and lots of them, have fed the consumer's penchant to have one of everything.
Oh, I know.
Or 10 of everything.
Well, look, you have an iPhone, and then you have an iPad, and then, of course, on the you've got to have a tabletop Apple. So just using Apple as one example.
How about the number of families that have five televisions throughout the home because you want one in the living room, one in the kitchen, one in the bedroom, one in the... we have one, frankly, and that's enough. But there are families that have 3, 5, and 10. Again, it's the issue of criticism on that point. It's just we have had largesse, consumer largesse, on the basis of globalization, on the basis of the unit costs of labor going down, and thus the unit costs of goods going down in lockstep. And that has actually been a huge subsidy for us in the West, in the developed world.
So, David, just recapping, our largest trade partner has been a significant creditor, and we've gotten all these goods, but they've benefited as well and turned right back around and loaned us the money. Okay, so we went from a society that produced things to pretty much a materialist consumer society.
It's been a fascinating shift over a 30-year period to watch this backwater country barely surviving its own system of beliefs, specifically communism, actually on the verge of social and economic collapse, to watch them become America's largest trade partner and most significant creditor. This is where the irony is immense. We owe a large part of the modern capitalist American dream, quote unquote, or at least sort of the materialist consumer orgy of the last two decades, to the credit extended to us.
From a communist country.
From a communist country.
That's pretty ironic.
So did we sell them or did they sell us the noose we'd hang ourselves with? This is a fascinating relationship, but it's this trade relationship that has been good for all of us and has at the same time been out of balance for a long time.
Well, just like a machine, you were talking about going circular. You know, anytime you have something out of balance, a lot of people who are listening may still remember the old record players, okay, where a record would go around and around. But if you put something out of balance on it, it would ultimately fly out of control.
Well, and that's, it's that imbalance you were talking about earlier of trade deficits, deficits where we import far more than we export versus our trade partners who are running the reciprocal surpluses. And we can roughly get caught up via printing more dollars or by issuing more IOUs in the forms of bills, notes, and bonds. It's about as close as we'll ever get as a country to a free lunch, and it's on that basis that it's been criticized as the deficit without tears. Now, that goes back to the 1960s and
right.
Jacques Rouffe. That's what he called it. And considering the massive surplus of currency reserves, which has now been accumulated over the last 20 to 30 years by our trade partners, they have in turn developed their own fiscal and economic imbalances in their own countries.
Okay, but let's face it, David, the reason we've been able to do this is because we've been the reserve currency of the world. I mean, it goes back to what you were mentioning earlier, the Bretton Woods system, which we have pretty much drifted away from. The Bretton Woods system was based on a gold standard, and like you said, muscle memory and just the size of our reserve currency has kept us in the front race. But before we discuss the Asian economic imbalances, why don't we go back and point out where we started at and why we're here?
Yeah, well, the dollar is vulnerable to displacement as the singular reserve currency in the world. We made that point in this most recent DVD presentation. So we've previously discussed the euro. That does, in fact, remain a dollar alternative, may emerge as stronger from the current crisis following a reconstitution of membership. Certainly, it is doomed to failure if something doesn't change in terms of the membership of the EU. But to the degree that the membership is switched, frankly, we may even see the reemergence of the Deutsche Mark. We'll have to see.
Okay, but if we didn't see that happen, could we see an Asian currency do the same thing?
The RMB may also take a path towards being internationalized. That's what's being discussed. Eiken Green is certainly a proponent of that, as well as many people who view that as almost sort of an inevitability. We have to have a multipolar currency world instead of a unipolar world focused on the U.S. dollar. As the world's second largest economy, it's easy to see why the RMB, the renminbi, could be in that mix. It's the journey towards that goal, which is both a long, challenging one, and one that we're not sure will be successful. We'll look at this as closely as we can, and certainly as critically as we can, with the guests that we have in the coming weeks, because the implications are grave. They are grave for the average standard of living here in America. Whatever the merits may be for having a multiplicity of currencies to trade in, it will come at a high cost to the U.S. consumer.
Well, David, not just the imbalances in our model, which worries us because we now realize we can't just continue to borrow and spend into infinity, but that imbalance is now going to be showing up with China. I mean, these guys know they're going to have to become internally consumptive or not survive the way they have in the past.
Well, the Chinese imbalance has fed the growth in the economy. I mean, this imbalance has allowed for a double-digit rate of growth in GDP for more than a decade.
It's been an explosion.
Yeah, and only recently has this rate of growth slowed. And it has slowed because the success of China has been rooted in exporting goods to the rest of the world, with Western Europe and the U.S. being the two best customers for Chinese goods. Now, anyone in business knows that if you've concentrated your business around one primary customer, you also have a tremendous amount of embedded risk in your business plan.
Sure, David. We've all known some salesman who's lost his largest account and literally just lost virtually all of his business.
Well, so as European and U.S. consumers have retrenched, the vulnerability of the Asian growth model has come fully into the light. You can only continue to grow if others continue to consume. And in the case of Americans, it was not merely consumerism drawing from savings or current income, but consumer borrowing as well for even more imported goods.
So it's consumption on steroids is what you're saying. I mean, when you can borrow and consume, and there really is no consequence.
So in reality, the best rate of growth in China was artificially high due to the credit bubble in the U.S. and European marketplaces. The long and the short of it is that China has to rebalance. The rebalancing away from being so export dependent and towards being more internally growth generative, domestic consumption in China, this is a growing priority. We certainly saw this outlined in the 5-year plan put out by the Politburo in the spring of this year. They like to do this. They like to say, like a good chess player, I don't want to know what the next move is. I want to know what the next 50 moves are, and let's work backwards. We know where we want to be 5 years from now. Now what do we need to do today to get there? There is, again, many a slip twixt the cup and the lip. Can they accomplish what they need to? If you recall our conversation with Stephen Roach about a year and a half ago, it related to the success variables driving China towards this goal and why he believed that it would be achievable. His one concern, if you recall the conversation, was that it will take time that they don't have or are running out of.
Well, and the other thing too, David, I mean, time is one thing, but the other thing too is to drive economics politically on a regular basis, which is the communist mindset. The communist mindset is to always go political first, and then you basically fashion the world the way you want it fashioned. Okay, now the problem with this transition is that the politicians have purposely given an advantage to manufacturing firms and exporters, but they've suppressed the currency, and that, of course, has its effect on the public.
Well, not only suppressing the currency, but giving advantaged borrowing rates. I mean, basically, when you control the banking system, when the government is the banking system, there's an unfair advantage given in the loan process. It depends if you are one of the select few who has been blessed from on high. If the Politburo likes what you're doing, if you are a part of one of the seven select areas in the economy, you will have favorable terms given to you in terms of the borrowing and lending.
But David, what does that do to household incomes and purchasing power of the normal person on the street?
Financial repression is always at the expense of households. And in this case, a suppressed currency is at the expense of household incomes and purchasing power. The household in China has for 20 to 30 years suffered so that industry could be built successfully. Now, you could argue that households are more employed and more households have moved out of poverty as a result, but you have not seen a commensurate growth in household income along with growth in GDP.
Well, and anybody who's retired knows that they're feeling that here in America. We've talked about repression quite a bit because when you keep rates artificially low, the average person cannot live on the interest of their savings.
No, and it turns out to be a subtle form of redistribution of capital. And as we are observing, it's not an American phenomenon exclusively. It's not an Asian phenomenon exclusively. It's actually quite common because it's one of the more common ways to steal without advertising it as such. Or I guess you could say increase taxes without advertising it as such or with permission. Industry is now vulnerable to the unreliable buying habits of the American and European middle class.
Okay, but David, even though those politicians have purposely given advantage to industry and manufacturing, that industry is vulnerable at this point because the people who were buying from them up to this point, which was the American who could borrow money, we're starting to work our way out of that. And they're having to try to figure out with these people who had been repressed within their own borders, how are they going to get them to buy a microwave and a washing machine and a cell phone?
Yeah, so the vulnerability in the economy is that because industry has been so reliant on American and European middle classes and their purchasing habits, Chinese now have to scramble to implement and rebalance their economy and reduce that export dependence, reduce government investment, and increase the household share of GDP. They have to increase their incomes, which, by the way, by gradually allowing the renminbi to appreciate, you are giving more and more advantage on a gradual basis to households where one renminbi is buying more than it was a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And that's basically increasing the purchasing power of the average household and empowering them to become more consumptive.
I guess the fascinating question to me, though, David, is politicians don't like to give up power. And this manufacturing base that, you know, it's like a fascist system. A fascist system really is corporatism, like what Mussolini said. And that is that there are large corporations in China and in America and around the world that have politically benefited from being the chosen ones. Okay, well, the politicians are also the chosen ones. When you're talking about building a base in China where the average man on the street now has consumptive power, you're going to have a power struggle from the top because the money's got to come from somewhere.
Well, and I think this is the fascinating contrast between the brilliant piece the World Bank put out earlier this year, 200, 300 pages of a detailed economic plan to be implemented by the Politburo and by the new leadership later this year in China. The challenge is immense as merely an economic problem to solve.
Right.
But with a one-party system, politicians that have long benefited from the existing economic model, which, as we've described, is losing efficacy as we speak, they're hesitant to allow for change at their expense because they have been the ones able to sort of wet their beak in this system.
Well, and you know what? I have to say, after knowing your dad for 25 years, I've known you for 25 years, your family is suspicious of communist systems. I mean,
well, it's just this. As a family, we've reflected on one of the great challenges of communist utopian ideals. We're all in it together, with some of us offering leadership according to our ability and in light of social need. But when the time comes, and it never seems to come, for power to be shared, for power to be collectivized, if you will, who steps down. Right. Those in power prefer to keep it.
Right.
Thus, the most kind-hearted socialist or communist falls prey to the temptation of power. And again, it's that recycling in a different environment of that old ring of Gyges from Plato's book, too, of the Republic, wherein you are given ultimate power, and once you have ultimate power, who is willing to cede it to the next? You're not. In fact, the abuse of power becomes more the norm. So you have the economic transitions, which are required. They are required in China. And yet you've got potentially political obstinacy towards making those changes. Will we see the changes necessary for China to remain on a growth path? Will they rebalance toward a sustainable growth path, or will they continue to buy time, and will the leadership try to enrich themselves at the expense of the people, knowing that they have an end game on the horizon? Again, why is this important to us? Because it's the old economic model which is in question, which is now broken, which they cannot rely on anymore. There are no more trade surplus dollars coming from Europe and the U.S. to the degree that they were, funding ultimately our budget deficits here in the United States. The strange coincidence, Kevin, is that the 5-year plan which the Chinese have set out to accomplish, which includes moving away from being export dependent, comes at a very inconvenient time, because over the next 5 years, we have to roll over almost the entire stock of U.S. treasuries. That's refinance all of U.S. treasuries, or nearly all of U.S. treasuries, and at the same time meet current funding needs. That is, the deficits that will run this year and next and the year after, which spells extreme pressure for the U.S. dollar and the U.S. debt markets. We're concerned about the U.S. dollar and the U.S. debt markets. This is where we live. This is where we raise our children. And isn't it interesting that our ability to thrive and succeed in this environment is tied to our chief creditor, China?
Well, and you know, it's interesting too. China's got to be taking note, because even though they're still growing, they are slowing. You know, we saw the first rate cut since 2008. So we're starting to see China try to stimulate its own economy from within.
And they're realizing that this old growth model is in fact past tense. We are seeing a slowdown in credit. Banks are falling woefully short of their loan targets for this year. And so yes, the People's Bank of China has recently, last week, cut rates. The first rate cut since 2008, 25 basis points. You look at the Shanghai Composite, it's failed to recover even half of its losses since 2008. So there certainly are a number of canaries in the coal mine in terms of a growth thematic for China. There is not the same growth thematic, because the macroeconomic picture globally has changed over the last 3 years, and they have to retool at some high political cost as well as economic cost.
Okay. Now, David, let's put this back in terms of how this affects people right here in America. Okay. There are newsletter writers out there. There are commentators, financial planners who've been very, very bullish about China over the last 4, 5, 6 years. And so far, they're coming up short. And this is something that we need to communicate to the people who are listening, that we're not pro, we're not against something so complex, something so large as this China issue, but we have to understand it before we start throwing money at it.
If they're successful, it will be one of the great growth stories of all time. And that hangs in the balance. Will they be successful, this major transition? Our concerns about the success of this retooling or rebalancing in China relate to what we know about how human beings respond to having power. And are they willing to give it up? It relates to what we see as both political and geopolitical realities as they are developing now and in the future. Will they be able to make this economic transition? It's more than just economics that applies.
Well, David, someone that we could probably talk to and get more information in a short period of time on China than anyone is Michael Pettis. And you'll be talking to him next week.
We consult him on a regular basis, professor of finance at Guangzhou School of Management, Peking University. He's also a part of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and has some very thoughtful insights into the Chinese rebalancing options, into predicting what the next few years will hold for China. And so we'll bring him into the conversation this next week. Following our conversation with Michael Pettis, we'll also invite Minxin Pei, who's a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. And again, this goes beyond finance. It goes beyond economics. It goes beyond politics. There is a strange crossover amongst the issues that are in play in China, in Europe, and certainly, ultimately, this does have an impact for us here in the United States. If you're concerned about the status of the dollar, the stability of the dollar, if you're concerned about pricing of bonds and the stability in both the bond and equity market, you have to understand that Asia, it features very prominently in stability in these areas. So our conversations with Minchin Pei, Michael Pettis, Stephen Roach, others on this issue, and then, of course, the research that we do on the ground in coming months, this will be a part of our move towards the second installment of our DVD. If you haven't watched the first, avail yourself of that opportunity, and the second will be available this fall as we explore China's role and Asian descendants and its impact on the U.S. bond and dollar markets.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.